Welcome, everyone, to episode 74 of Underserved. Joining me today in studio is Neil Kao, Principal, Transaction Advisory Services at RSM. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Neil, thank you so much for joining us today.
Andrew, thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here today with you.
So way back when you were a kid, were you interested in technology? Were you excited about it?
That's a great question. No, I would definitely say no. My younger brother was. He was the one that was into computers. For me, I will say that growing up in an Asian family, you're either going to be a doctor or you're going to be an engineer. So my parents had me down the path of being a doctor. And growing up, that's pretty much what my goal was.
So you graduate high school and you go into like pre-med somewhere?
I went to pre-med at UMass.
UMass Amherst?
UMass Amherst. ZUMass, yes.
Yeah, nice. I'm a fellow Minuteman. Where did you live when you were on campus?
I lived in the Southwest campus area, in the high rise of all places. My freshman year, I was in what we call the penthouse. So I was on the 22nd floor of Washington.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
So how many fire alarms did you have on your average?
Too many, but I got a lot of good exercise.
What is it like studying pre-med at UMass?
It was actually a great experience. So when I joined as a freshman, I was invited to be part of what they call the BioTap program, which is kind of basically an honors biology group, which was why I was placed in one of the two floors, high floors up in the Washington building. It was pretty much reserved for all the students that were in this BioTap program, which is, again, an advanced program for pre-med majors.
So they take some of the best pre-med students and stick them up in some of the biggest party floors in the university.
Which is really funny. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when I decided to go to UMass and, you know, we had the option of selecting where we wanted to live on campus, I had no idea. You know, back then, this was what, 93? It wasn't like I could Google to say, hey, you know, what's the best place to live at UMass Amherst? So I just decided Southwest based on the campus tour that we had. It looked like it was a nice area, right? Didn't know that it was Party Central for UMass. So it was definitely very interesting. But yes, so they pretty much reserved the top two floors of Washington for us, which was great, right? At first, I thought, fantastic, you know, high rise, penthouse level, this is going to be great. And kind of like you mentioned before, right? How many fire alarms did I have to go through at 2 a.m.? That was the worst. Going down the stairs to evacuate the building wasn't as bad, but going back up the stairs 22 flights, that was pretty tough.
I wasn't smart enough to see ahead either, but my roommate that I met during freshman orientation, Brad, who I'm still friends with today, said, hey, that looks like it could be trouble. Why don't we live in the engineering dorms? And then if we want to cause trouble, we can always go down there.
So you were in what, Northeast?
Yeah, I lived in Crabtree in Northeast.
Okay. Yeah, I heard stories about that, about the streaking every year.
Yeah, I mean, there was a quad, there was some streaking, there was, you know, a lot of activities, but, you know, it was relatively tame by UMass standards.
Well, funny you bring that up. My brother-in-law, he lived in Northeast, and he was a year older than me. So I didn't know him back then. It was just afterwards. And yeah, so we have a lot of stories all the time about the streaking that went on when he was there living in Northeast.
Well, you know, we had a really good basketball team. It was exciting times.
It was. So when I was there, Marcus Camby was also a freshman. I was actually in his biology 101 class, believe it or not. And he lived in Southwest as well. So it was kind of great to actually kind of see him walk around, be in the same class as him. You know, I tell my kids, right, not that they know Marcus Camby very well, but, you know, they're big into basketball. And anybody that played in the NBA, they think is awesome. So I'll tell them the story that I was best buddies with Marcus Camby.
Did you help him pass bio? Yeah.
Sure.
During your junior year, though, you had kind of a informative event that made you rethink this whole pre-med thing.
Yeah. So I was doing an internship and we were working on Leishmania cells, right? So there were these bacteria that basically ate flesh. They were growing these in petri dishes in one of the labs up actually pretty close to the Northeast campus. And, you know, I was working with a lot of medical students and doctors who were also taking part in this research. And as I got to know them a little bit more, you know, every day when we came into the labs to check on these Petri dishes and so forth, they either looked really tired, they didn't look very happy. And as I thought about it a little bit more, I didn't really want that type of lifestyle. So it was second semester. I remember it very clearly. It was second semester of my junior year where I said to myself, I don't think I want to go through with this. It was pretty difficult, though, I'll tell you. As I thought about it, I was very clear, to me at least, that that's the path that I no longer wanted to go down. But how do you tell my parents that, right?
Yeah.
Because their dream, for me at least, was that I was going to become a doctor. And, you know, it wasn't just, according to them, it wasn't just their dream. It would be a fantastic accomplishment for my grandparents who were in Vietnam at the time, you know, when I was going to school, for them to see the first doctor in the family.
No pressure.
No pressure, right? But again, like I said, it was very clear to me, second semester, junior year, that it wasn't something that I wanted to do.
Okay, so I'm not surprised that researching flesh-eating bacteria and watching all these burnt-out research folks didn't turn you on. What do you decide to do instead?
So I basically stayed within the field, but concentrated more on health sciences, specifically exercise science. So, you know, a lot of the classes that I already took would still account towards my health science degree. So I decided to complete my degree in exercise science and then figure it out.
And what's happening with your brother at this time?
He was at Northeastern University. And so if I was a junior at the time, he was a sophomore. He was in an internship, a co-op at Northeastern, working for Humphrey Schlossberg Digital Advertising Agency in Boston.
Did they become Digitas?
They became Digitas, okay. Yes. So here he was, what, a 19-year-old kid, big in technology, doing web development for this company. And after, I think it was a six-month co-op, he got an offer to join full-time at an incredible salary, especially back then. And I'm scratching my head trying to figure out what am I going to do after graduation. And here he is buying two cars and, you know, living it up in downtown Boston.
The late 90s, the dot-com days.
Yes, absolutely.
What do you decide to do to retool with your exercise degree?
So I graduated and started to figure out what was it I want to do. I didn't know at the time. So I started to look at just want ads back then. Again, Boston Globe, right? It wasn't like logging into Monster or anything like that at the time. Just to see, let's find something and figure it out. As I'm looking at these want ads or these classified ads, and, you know, I came across, you know, Oracle DBA. I didn't know what Oracle and DBA was, right? But $125 an hour. Looking at all these other software related type roles, $100 an hour. Obviously, I knew what my brother and how well he was doing. So I thought to myself, let's look into it a little bit more.
So do you end up going to Clark University for a little bit?
I did, yes. So I decided to take the client server certification program at Clark University, signed up for that. Back then, they pretty much trained you on Visual Basic. If you might remember Power Builder.
Yeah.
From a database standpoint, they were using Sybase. But yeah, so that's kind of how I got my start in development. What was great was I started to find my passion, right? Building things. And it was that great feeling of saying, all right, this doesn't exist, or I'm interested in doing this, or I want to automate something, and being able to do it. And at that moment, as I was taking my certification for software development, like I said, I found my passion and never looked back.
So what's your first job in the industry?
So my first job was a Visual Basic programming job, or a company that pretty much specialized in freight bill consolidation for large companies. So the company's name was called Corpay. And this great guy, if it's okay, I'm going to mention his name, Brian Andrews. He gave me my first shot at my first development job. You know, somebody I always continue to look up to. He was my age. So at the time, you know, a young guy doing very well, you know, managing this software product internally. And again, giving me a chance to come in and teach me and get me started in my career. So very thankful for him. You know, came in, worked on a VB application, internal desktop application. We were working with a system called the Kodak Open Image System. basically scanning hundreds, if not thousands, of pages of bills on a daily basis, having it transformed digitally, and then creating this front-end Visual Basic application that pretty much brought in the image of the bill, pre-populate based on what it can read on the image at the time, pre-populate some fields within these VB forms, and then allowing pretty much a person to basically match up the data, correct the data, and then kind of move it through the process.
That was pretty early on to do that.
It was. It definitely was. And it was one of my first applications that I worked on in the real world.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Syrinx, the developer-founded, developer-run software consulting company. For more information, visit syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
So where do you move on to from there?
So from there, I went to Allstate's Research and Management. They're no longer around. They were actually purchased, I believe, by BlackRock. But I guess you can say they were, at the time, a competitor of State Street Bank. And it was always, I guess, a debate as to who created the first mutual fund. Was it State Street Research and Management, or was it State Street Bank? So I moved over to SSRM.
So who do you think won that fight?
I guess because I worked at SSRM, I'm going to say State Street Research and Management, although I did consult at State Street Bank at one time.
So are you like writing trading applications?
I was, yes. I worked very closely with the trading floor. It was only, I want to say, four or five people up in the trading floor at the time. And, you know, whatever they needed in terms of reports or applications that allowed them to look at portfolios much more easily or to track their trades and things like that. So, you know, it wasn't any one particular application that I worked on. It was just based on the needs of the trading floor.
You see that in a lot of FinServ companies, like whether it's mutual funds or hedge funds, they have their kind of pet programmers that are tasked with, hey, the traders need this. They need better research, faster. They need it to tie in with this trading system. So I imagine you're kind of working for and answering to a lot of these type A traders.
Absolutely. And I'll say at the time, I want to say I was roughly 22 years old, working for, you know, a very large Fortune company. And it was nerve-wracking, to be very honest with you. So I was at Corpay, my previous job, for 6 months. And then, you know, during that time, recruiters were calling constantly. They had these great deals or these great job opportunities. And, you know, with one or two phone calls, one or two interviews, and you're jumping over to another place. So I didn't have much experience behind me when I joined State Street Research and Management. And to be put in the trading floor where it was intense, the traders, they were gods within the firms. Whatever they wanted, they got. So there was a lot of pressure, I want to say. And it wasn't like I was working with another senior person either. Pretty much just got thrown into this cage and had to figure things out very quickly.
Definitely no buffer there.
No, but I want to say it taught me a lot. Number one, I guess, certainly it helped me grow thick skin, not to take things too personally, because I really believe they weren't being personal. It was just, it's a very stressful environment. And whatever they needed, they wanted immediately. So I just had to learn to manage that. And certainly because of the dynamic environment and how quickly things need to be delivered, it just really taught me to stay focused and how to prioritize and pretty much how to get things done with whatever tool sets I had.
But after getting a little more experience, you get a fateful call from Scott Dessing.
Yes, great guy. I think you know him. Yeah, so Scott, I love the guy. So I'll share you a couple of funny stories with him. But for this, Scott calls me up, never met the guy. I don't even know how he got my name and number. He told me about this opportunity in Cambridge and said, hey, you interested in interviewing? I said, sure. It's a startup company focused on partner relationship management applications. I wasn't building web-based applications at the time, so I thought it would be exciting to start moving into that and learning that. He calls me back after the initial phone call that same day and says, yep, they're ready to talk to you at 5:30. Can you make it? I said, yes, I can, Scott. The problem is I'm not in a suit and there's no way I can get home in time to get into a suit and come back out to Cambridge. He goes, don't worry about it. I'll give him a heads up. I had to take the T in from downtown Boston. Didn't know where I was going. Again, no Google map to tell me exactly where to go and how to get there. So figure it out. Had to take the red line out there. I think it was what?
Central Square.
Central Square. That's right. Out to Central Square. And then from there, had to figure out which direction to go on Mass Ave. Figured it out. Got there at about 5:40 45, so I was 15 minutes late. I was sweating, right? And I wasn't dressed. But Scott did a great job of preparing them in terms of what to expect. So after my interview and I got home, he calls me up and says, when can you start? So great experience with that. That's how I got to meet Scott and kept that relationship going ever since. Never met the guy until 2010, and I can definitely tell you more about that. Yep.
All right. So that was Channelwave Software?
That was Channelwave Software, yes.
What did they do?
They built a partner relationship management application. So I guess you can say probably the precursor to what we know as Salesforce.com today. We built web-based applications customized to customers like 3Com. That was the one I worked on specifically, that allowed them to manage their channel partners primarily, and as well as their Salesforce.
After that, you end up doing some consulting here and there?
Yes. So while I was still at Channelwave Software, I was able to kind of switch my hours so that I could work at nights. So I didn't need to come into Channelwave Software till after 5 p.m. and I would work there in the office until about midnight, because I found this great opportunity at a company called Event Zero. They were a startup consulting company as well. They were working on some great websites and e-commerce sites, and they reached out to me to work on a payroll application, a web-based payroll application for a company called CBS Payroll. And they wanted to be able to have their clients manage payroll all on the web. Really exciting opportunity, you know, working in Microsoft ASP technologies. And the backend was actually a COBOL backend, believe it or not. So I didn't have to touch that. We had a specialist who worked on that. I just had to work on the front end.
Well, that's good. My first job at EDS, I had to get my hands dirty with COBOL, and I still can't wash them clean enough. So after working two jobs and juggling some consulting gigs, you end up doing a stint at Business Technology Partners?
Yes. So they had a fairly sizable team here in Boston, and I was brought on to actually work and consult with State Street Bank. State Street Bank was working with Business Technology Partners at the time to build a web-based project management tool for the bank. I was brought on as the senior front-end developer for that web-based project management tool.
And you're doing all this web dev, you're doing the stuff for State Street. Just around the time the dot-com bubble is starting to burst, any other notable things happen while you're there?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously during that time, we had to witness 9/11, which was obviously very tragic. The day of 9/11, that morning, my manager, who was based out of New York, originally had me coming out to Boston to meet with some folks in one of those buildings. And I couldn't go. I don't remember why I couldn't go, but I couldn't go. And he and another person out of the New York office, they were actually heading over to that building for a 9 a.m. meeting. The moment they stepped out of the subway, it was just chaos. Had they been there a little earlier, they could have potentially been in the building. You know, somebody was watching over them that day. But yeah, it was just something that obviously was very tragic, but for me, kind of pretty close and personal.
You were down there just a couple of weeks after that, right?
I was, yes, for a meeting. Yeah. I still remember the smell, just to give you a sense of how clear it is still in my mind. What really got me was the moment I got to New York. And, you know, I want to say that the building, the office that we were out of, pretty close to Wall Street. And there were ashes on the sills of our office, even from that distance. Like I said, it was just the smell. I can't really describe it other than certainly that smoky type smell. It's still very clear in my mind today.
I remember being there shortly after, and it was like combusted jet fuel and like asbestos or some just like friable gross stuff had been like burned up. It
right.
was just haunting.
You're right. And at that time, I didn't think about what was in the air, right? But it was such an incredible sight to see.
I am altering the scope of the project. Pray I don't alter it any further.
Excellent. Let the scope creep flow. Keep adding features.
To deploy the release,
deliver first. You must.
I find your lack of faith in change management disturbing.
Missing your deadline is the path to the dark side.
If you or someone you know manages software development projects, we can help. Call the offices of Syrinx Consulting. Syrinx provides software consultants who hit the ground running to help you deliver right away. Our toll-free number is 888-579-7469, option 1. Or you can live chat with Berg at syrinx.com. That's syrinx.com.
Syrinx is not a law office, and this is not legal advice. Offer valid only in the United States. Hablamos español, pero solo un poco y no tener ni pies ni cabeza. Saludos.
Now, after that, you end up working for your first of two stints with Engage to Excel.
So I stayed on with Business Technology Partners for a few months after the, the burst, right? And, you know, a lot of companies were going out of business or certainly downsizing for sure. And that wasn't different with Business Technology Partners, at least for the Boston office. So, you know, we had, like I said earlier, but like 10 people or so out of that office. And I was the last man standing, I guess you can say, for that office. And yeah, the CEO of Business Technology Partners, he was great. You know, he was like, hey, Neil, you know what? Why don't you just stay on with us. We'll rebound from this and, you know, you can help us regrow our Boston office and presence. And certainly I was excited about it, but at the same time, they would have just been spending money they didn't have to keep me on board. And I just couldn't knowingly do that, even though I was very grateful for that offer. So I departed ways with them, still in touch with them today, you know. Moved on to a company, like you said, as Engage to Excel. Started out there as a senior software developer focused on Microsoft technologies, which, you know, has always been what I was focused on up to that point.
A lot of .NET.
ASP still at the time, right? SQL Server. Oh my goodness, I forgot what version, but yeah, early version of SQL Server still. But yes, I helped move them into Microsoft.NET at that time.
And what does Engage to Excel do? Like, what's their core business?
So Engage to Excel, the primary business is focused on what's called employee engagement solutions. So the company is focused on programs that help engage employees, such as what we call length of service programs or service awards programs. So a lot of large customers like Honeywell, like Procter & Gamble, UPS, those types of companies. Engage to Excel provides solutions that help large companies manage those types of programs. And we offer the consulting as well as the technology behind that. For example, we would receive these updated data files of employees and bring it into our system, massage the data, apply the business rules based on the company needs for these types of programs, and set up the recognition for the companies. And that might mean, you know, sending managers reminder emails, sending presentation recognition packets to the appropriate locations so that managers have it on the day of the employee's anniversary so that they can present them with an award, with a trophy. And then beyond that, a lot of companies let their employees choose their award. And over the years, the awards have shifted from, you know, trophies and jewelry and class rings and things like that to more everyday consumer items that you find on Amazon.com. So we went through that transition. Our technology transitioned to support the changing needs of employees. So no longer are they really interested in the personalized gold jewelry or the lapel pins. They're moving more towards, hey, you know what? I want to go get Bose stereos. I want a canoe. I want some type of experience like a trip. So that's the type of solution in which we provided.
What was the coolest perk you saw in either the points catalog or the other stuff that they handed out?
Their highest tier catalog had a sports car. Now, when I was still there, I didn't recall seeing anybody with enough points in their points balance to be able to redeem for that at the time. But I will say that there were many people with points banks that weren't too far away from allowing them to receive that.
That's a heck of a loyalty perk.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. You know, I remember visiting their office in Illinois as part of my role there as, you know, CIO/CTO, because we offered technology services and a technology platform to help them manage their, you know, overall solutions. I played a big role in client management. I would pay visits to a lot of these large clients, and so I love visiting them. Let's just put it that way. They had this great building, and being a Japanese-based company, the best part is using their restrooms. You go in there and they had these great toilets, right? Automated toilets, bidets, whatever you want to call them. But it was awesome. Their bathrooms were just awesome.
All right. So after a pretty good stint at Engage to Excel, you end up, was it Zensar or was it Akibia? And then they get bought.
It was Akibia. And then shortly after I left, they were purchased by an India-based company called Zensar. So I was brought on to lead the applications development team there, primarily focused on internal applications to help improve efficiencies within company. So what Akibia provided was they were basically a parts bank. They were a third-party support company for servers like IBM servers and appliances and Dell technologies and things like that. So we had different parts banks throughout the United States as well as throughout Europe. We would have field service engineers, and these companies that were using these, you know, servers from these manufacturers would rely on us as their support team.
So like a power supply dies or a hard drive croaks, you guys are
CPU,
like
CPU, exactly.
We'll have it there. How quick?
I want to say as little as 2 to 3 hours or upwards of maybe a day.
So are you still doing .NET there, or do you end up moving into management at all?
I want to say that was the beginning of the end of me actually coding, unfortunately. So yeah, I moved into primarily a management role at that time. I didn't really write code in terms of being part of my job, but certainly as a mentor to the development team there. They were using Microsoft.NET already as the technology stack, but I want to say that there was a lot of room for improvement in how they use it. Kind of going back to how I got into .NET 1.0, right? And not using it appropriately. You know, they were using technologies, but certainly, again, areas in which they could improve how they used it. So that's kind of, I want to say, the value add that I brought to the team when I first joined.
So they were driving around that sports car in first gear.
That's a great way to put it, Andrew. Absolutely. Yes.
So you help lift everyone's game there, and you also get some exposure to data centers and security.
Yeah. So before that, it was all about software for me, right? Didn't really care too much about how it was hosted, who was hosting it, how it was managed. We always had somebody to do that, or I always had somebody to do that as long as I was able to deliver the software. Moving into this role at Akibia, even though I didn't have any hands-on responsibilities as it related to security or data center management, that was what the company did. So worked with a lot of very, very smart people around data center management and network security. And, you know, a lot of these smart people brought me under their wings in terms of just allowing me to shadow, to sit in on meetings with clients, calls with clients, and just learn. And I'm kind of glad I did that. You know, I could have easily just sat there and just focused on my area of responsibility. But, you know, there was just something about learning about how data centers ran and how network security worked. So I'm kind of glad I did that.
So you returned to Engage to Excel after that for quite a long stint. Did that new knowledge come in handy?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So throughout my career, a lot of luck, happenstance and luck happened to me. And this was one of those kind of decisions, right, that I made when I was at Akibia to kind of try to pick up an understanding of data center management and network security that helped me with coming back to Engage to Excel. So the reason why I came back to Engage to Excel was it was purchased by a company based in North Carolina. And the CEO of the acquiring company learned of what I did when I was there the first time, you know, in terms of delivering one of the first SaaS-based solutions in the employee engagement space. He reached out to me actually through the current CIO, my previous boss, basically. He was looking to leave after the acquisition. So he gave my name to the CEO of the acquiring company. His name was Brett. And Brett reached out to me, said, hey, here's what's going on. I heard about what you did, impressed. And one of the major reasons why we acquired that company is because of the technology. So I want to talk to you. So had a great conversation with him. And he came up from North Carolina. We had dinner. And he invited me down to North Carolina to check out the headquarters there. About a week later, received a phone call from him. And he said, what do you think? So it was pretty easy for me to decide to come back.
And now that you come back, like, is your role expand at the company?
Yeah. So he offered me the CIO position. So, you know, moving from Akibia, obviously I was very comfortable with the software development experience and background that I developed over the many years at that time. But now having, I wouldn't say expert knowledge of, but certainly a comfortable understanding of, you know, managing infrastructure and managing network security. So I felt that I had a good foundation to join the company and, you know, serve as their CIO and figured, all right, I'll fake it until I make it, right?
It is a popular theme. Almost everyone that's been on Underserved, and since I was guest number one and host number one, I'll include myself at one time or another, was like, I don't know how to do this, but I guess I'll just figure it out as I go. And I come up to speed pretty quickly on things, so make it happen. And it's what you have to do.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, obviously, you got to have some level of foundation and some amount of comfort level, right? And confidence, right? To even take this type of position on. But I felt that I was confident enough and that I had enough foundation and background to at least try it, right? And certainly I'm glad I did. I 14 years later, I think I made the right decision.
Well, you mentioned luck. And I've heard a bunch of quotes over the years that luck is the intersection of hard work and opportunity, or it's amazing how lucky you get when you work hard. I think if you're putting yourself in the position to win and you're trying hard, that, yeah, eventually you'll catch some breaks.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. And I think you said it very well. Certainly, I think you make your luck, right? You don't know it at the time, perhaps, but you make your luck. And at RSM today, and I'm sure we'll get into that, as a principal there, I'm being asked to join different types of groups, mentor groups. And, you know, we're big in what we call cultural type groups, you know, whether it's inspiration with the focus on helping and mentoring our team members with Asian backgrounds, or even others, which I'd love to talk about. But, you know, as I talk to what I'll call younger team members, I come back to telling them that, you know, there's always luck, right, associated to your professional growth. At least that's what I believe. But you make your luck. And how you make your luck is, you know, you work hard, you network, you try to meet the right people. And when I say right people, how do you know it's the right people when you meet the people? You don't, right? And a lot of times the right people are the people that just align with you, right? As you meet them, you just hit it off. You have commonalities, perhaps. You have similar backgrounds, or you have similar goals, right? It's just something that connects you. And you continue to connect with them, build that relationship with them. And somehow, later on in life, you don't know when, it just comes back. You know, I mentioned earlier, right? I mean, Scott, I didn't know the guy. He reached out to me. He connected me to a great startup, and I learned a lot there. And it was one of the steps in developing my career to where I am at today. He continued to stay in touch with me. I continued to stay in touch with him, even though we didn't do much in terms of working together for 10 plus years. And then suddenly, you know, he reconnected with me when I was at Engaged to Excel, and boom, we brought on 10 plus contractors over a period of 4 or 5 years. And one of the people he helped me bring on is one of my best friends now as well. Network, meet people, stay connected, build those relationships, because you just don't know where it will lead, but it will lead somewhere at some point in time.
So last September, it led you to RSM. What are you up to there?
So as I mentioned, I joined the firm as a principal. You get the title of partner if you have your CPA. It's pretty much the difference. So I don't have my CPA. But yeah, I was fortunate to join the firm as a principal. So essentially a partner owner within the firm. And where my focus is to help lead the operations due diligence practice in what we call Transaction Advisory Services Group. Tend to work with private equity and other investors, but we also work with large corporations as well who are looking to buy or sell companies. And they would work with us, bring us on to due diligence, whether it's financial due diligence. My focus specifically within operations due diligence is IT, cyber, HR, and software product diligence.
Does everyone have their 2FA turned on?
You got it. Yeah. So again, I guess, you know, kind of how my career has developed, right? So software development, data center management, move into network security, becoming CIO of Engaged to Excel. And as CIO, and what we did at Engaged to Excel, we were managing and storing sensitive private information, right? A lot of PII data, employee data. So obviously, besides the focus on cybersecurity and managing and securing our networks and applications, I was also the front person in terms of managing all these fantastic due diligence and vendor questionnaires and things like that from our clients. So, you know, I sat on the other side of the table of being the one that had to answer all these questions, hundreds, if not thousands of questions, depending on how deep they wanted to go into assessing our network and applications. And now I get to sit on the other side of the table, being the one asking those questions and giving those questionnaires and judging a company and whether or not they're secure or not.
Which one was harder?
Being on the receiving end of it, I want to say, is the toughest part. No matter what size company you are, the reality is there's always room for improvement. And when you're on the receiving end and you know you're not doing it as well, or you know you could do it better, so when you're answering those questions, it becomes a little difficult. You know, how much do you answer? Do you feel that it's adequate even though you know there's room for improvement? Being on this side of the table, it's just asking the questions. I think the good thing about me in terms of playing the role that I play at RSM and the focus that I have is that I think I have a little bit of empathy that I bring to the deals, and that I know what they're feeling, how they're feeling, and the concerns that they might have or the challenges that they go through, right? I'm not that auditor that comes in and, you know, ask the questions and think that it's just a yes, no, black or white type question answer that I should receive. I kind of understand, you know, I put myself in their shoes.
Well, when you're not answering tough questions or asking tough questions, what are you doing for fun outside of work?
I have four kids, right? And they span, my oldest is, oh my goodness, going to be 21 at the end of April. And my youngest is 9 years old. So a big gap, three boys, one girl. Pretty much my fun is whatever their fun is. So I'm a soccer coach where I live, big soccer town growing up. So my 22-year-old son now, he played soccer for town ever since he was 8 years old. And ever since he was 8 years old, I started to coach. And then I continued that on with my second, who's a junior in high school now. And then, of course, my 9 year old now. So that has been my life. I enjoy it. In addition to soccer coach, I also serve on the town soccer board. So definitely enjoy that as well, right? Kind of volunteering, paying back a little bit to the community for all that they've done for my family and I. I'm a dance dad, I guess, if you want to call it that. I'm not a good dancer. You do not want to see me dance, even though I did take ballroom dancing as an elective at UMass. I'm starting to understand a little bit more about the dance world, right? Competition dancing and things like that. So I find myself more as their chauffeur every weekend, every day.
I'm familiar with the dad taxi grind, and I have three daughters that play soccer. My wife coached them, was on the board and all that stuff. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
Well, you know, I will say this, that maybe I'm just getting at that age, whatever that age is. But, you know, I remember a time growing up, my parents, you know, they look back and they'll say, you're going to miss this, or you don't want time to go by too fast and enjoy the moment, right? And growing up, it's like, yeah, I can't wait till this day. I can't wait till I do that. I can't wait till I drive. I can't wait till I turn 21, whatever those milestones are. And now I'm like my parents, I feel like, right? Where I'm going to like, can time just stop for a second, right? Can we just cherish this moment? Can we just like keep this vision, this image in our head a little bit longer? I'm becoming that dad, you know? So, you know, my kids, when I say things like that, they're rolling their eyes and like, whatever, dad. But yeah, I think I hit whatever that age is, right? That parents tend to hit, that, you know, you just look back and you go, oh my goodness, time's flying by too fast. Let's take in the moment.
I wholeheartedly agree. So Neil, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with the listeners of Underserved.
Andrew, thank you so much for having me today. I had a blast doing my first podcast, so thank you so much.
We're glad it was with us. And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.